Welcome to the Errata Movie Podcast. Today we're talking about three relatively new movies, The Visitor, Stop Loss, and the new film from Errol Morris called Standard Operating Procedure. This is Robert Davis. You know, I still remember the first time I saw one of those magnets that you can stick on the back of your car that says support our troops. You know, the ones, they look sort of like a yellow ribbon. I thought, oh, that's kind of interesting. It reminded me of a sticker that you get to put on your shirt that says, I voted. You know, make a donation and they give you this magnet to put on the back of your car. Support the troops. Encourage other people to support the troops. It's kind of like war bonds. You know, it used to be that you could support a war by buying war bonds and that money would go directly into funding the war effort. And I don't have anything against these magnets, but I feel a little naive for discovering that that isn't the case, that you can go into a gas station or Walmart or wherever and buy one of these magnets and put it on your car, and nothing in this transaction actually goes to support the troops, except for this sort of indirect way that you keep commerce rolling. Well, today we're talking about two movies that, each in its own way, is about how we do or don't support our troops. One of them is called Stop Loss, starring Ryan Phillippe. It's made by the same filmmaker who made a movie a few years ago called Boys Don't Cry, and that title actually would probably work for this movie as well. And we'll also give you the definitive take on the much-debated Errol Morris film Standard Operating Procedure. But before we talk about those two, we're going to revisit a movie that we've talked about before on this podcast. Earlier this year, when we were talking about the Sundance Film Festival, I mentioned that one of my favorite movies was a movie called The Visitor. And now that that movie is playing in theaters around the country, and J. Robert Parks has had a chance to see it, we're going to talk about that movie again, and we'll also hear a little bit of my chat with the writer and director of the film, Thomas McCarthy. It's a movie about our world as we're globalizing and building walls.
Oh, hi.
Sounded good, Walter.
I'm sorry.
Come on, I'll show you. Walter and I are going up to the park to play, and we'll come back then. Promise, Habibti.
What does Habibti mean?
It means beloved one.
Does she know that?
That was fun, right?
Oh, yeah.
We haven't talked about new movies in a while, but one movie I had a chance to see that you saw at Sundance and we talked about a little bit in the Sundance podcast was The Visitor. And so I thought I might offer a few thoughts and then maybe, you know, give you a chance to think some more about that film.
Yeah, since I've already talked about it. Your turn.
I liked it. I don't love it. It's a quiet film, and that's both, I think, a strength of it as well as maybe a little bit of a weakness of the film. And so this film about this professor, economics professor, right? And he's bored with his life. He's single. He doesn't get any gratification from teaching.
He's a widower.
He's a widower. That's right. Right. An important distinction. And so he has to go down to New York City for a conference. And apparently he has an apartment in New York City that he's just sort of held on to for years and years and years. I found that a bit strange, but I'm thinking, man, that would be pretty prime real estate that you just hang on to for years. But anyway, I understand that sets the movie in motion. When he gets to his apartment, he finds a couple who are immigrants, and as we find out relatively soon, they're illegal immigrants, who have just been sort of staying in his apartment, thinking that they were legitimately staying there. And
they thought they were subletting it from someone.
That's right.
Turns out that someone had no right to be there.
Right.
Legal right to be there.
Right. And then the professor reacts, and I think, again, it's one of those things that you sort of have to accept on faith. His reaction is probably not how I would have reacted, but it sets the story in motion, and so I can accept that. But he, at first, is going to kick these people out, and then realizing they have nowhere to go, he sort of invites them to come back and stay in his apartment while he also stays in the apartment. The story then progresses from there as he befriends the man who plays a drum. Should we give this away?
Maybe it's too much. Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe that's.
But anyway, of the things I love about the movie is how these sort of things unfold. You don't really know where it's going to go.
And yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's right. Although for me, and I guess maybe this is the part of the Quiet film that I didn't resonate as well, is I had a pretty good sense of where it was going to go.
Okay.
Not with the one shift. That was, I didn't necessarily see that coming, but the, once he lets this couple stay in the apartment, I had a pretty good sense of where we were going.
Okay.
And then once another character shows up, I also sort of knew where we were going with that. It didn't take away my pleasure at all, but it wasn't maybe the same sort of surprise that, that I know you had talked about. But Richard Jenkins is great. You know, it's nice to sort of see him have a, you know, he's been such a small character actor in TV shows and movies. And so it's like I've seen his face, and then it's like, oh, wow, that's nice to see him get a chance to do that. And I'm a sucker for movies about cultural boundaries and people crossing cultural boundaries and what that looks like. I think living in a big city like Chicago, that's just part of life. And so it's nice to see that part of life on the big screen. So often in movies, particularly American films, everyone's homogenous. You know, everyone is, you know, whatever you expect them to be.
Yeah.
And here, people are very different, and that's part of the movie. So I liked it. It was it's pleasant. But I'm not sure I would go past that.
Yeah.
So.
I did like it more than that. I think it is plausible that he, as you put it, he invites them to stay, but really it's, he doesn't kick them out immediately. Mm-hmm. I mean, what happens is they're, you know, they realize they're in the wrong. They're embarrassed. They're packing up all their stuff to go out. But they've been living in this place, so it's their home. And so as he sees them sort of lugging their stuff out to the bus, you know, he feels bad about that.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, it's not their fault. And so if you know, he comes up with a compromise, and if the way it sort of is told is nicely elided, you know, it just sort of happens. Mm-hmm. And it's, I feel like it was believable, and it told us something about this guy that he's not, up to this point, he's fairly hard to read. He's mm-hmm. got a very stoic face. He's got, and so it tells us a little something about him. He's not heartless.
Yeah.
Step one, he's not heartless. But I do agree with you that it is leading us towards certain emotional cues. I mentioned it when we talked before about Sundance, that I sort of put it into this category of the new American realism, as Manola Dargis called it. But there are these several movies at Sundance that were very quiet, character-focused dramas: Sugar, Mama's Man, Ballast, The Visitor. A lot of people who sort of felt the same thing didn't put The Visitor into this category. Mm-hmm. Partly because it played previously at Toronto, which I missed this year, and so I was seeing it fresh for the first time. And so to me, they all sort of fit together.
Yep.
But I do recognize also that it is fundamentally different in some ways. Those movies are very rigorous art films, you could say. They all work in different ways. Each one is distinct. But The Visitor is one, as I said to someone else, is one I could recommend to my mom.
Yep, exactly.
I couldn't recommend the other three to my mom. Therefore, I know it must be functioning in some different way. I recognize that.
Yep.
And I recognize that it wants me to feel certain ways. Mm-hmm. And it's provoking emotional responses. Mm-hmm. But I didn't mind that. And I so enjoyed every one of these characters. Mm-hmm. And I so love a movie that has no villains.
Yep,
necessarily. I want them all to... I want it to work out.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing, of course, as I mentioned before, is that the title... once I sort of clued into the fact that the title, The Visitor, was constantly shifting, and that it was shifting in such a way that I felt the writer-director, Thomas McCarthy, had to have intended it to shift that way.
Right.
And so I felt like it was a beautiful title that provoked a lot of questions that I liked thinking about.
No, I can agree with that. Yeah, and I don't think I went in with high expectations. In other words, this is not a, like, I'm disappointed because it didn't fulfill expectations. It's
so you didn't believe me when I told you it was great before?
No, it's just, I think the way you phrased it, maybe not for the podcast, but afterwards, was, you know, I think you'll like this film, but you may not love it. And that is how I felt about it. I like the film, and I like the acting, and I'm... but I wouldn't go past it. But I think it's very worthwhile, and I think particularly, like, it is the sort of film that I could show to my parents, and they would enjoy it, and they might enjoy it even for different reasons than I do, and that'd be okay. And so I'm happy to sort of applaud it in that kind of movie all the time,
because
there aren't always movies that I can do that with.
Yeah.
So
one thing that I do in my film writing that it may be different from other critics is that I never feel like I'm recommending movies to people. When I'm writing, say, for Pace magazine or even for my blog, I don't know who's reading. It's such a broad group of people. I can't possibly really make any recommendations. All I can say is I liked this movie.
Yeah.
When I'm talking to, you, my sister, my mom, my family, people right. I know, friends. Well, I sort of know their taste and I can say, you know what, mm-hmm. I bet you would like this movie or you wouldn't love this movie or whatever, you know. Right. In those cases, I can make recommendations. At times, though, even though this is sort of my view on how criticism works for me, there are times when I feel like I love a movie that perhaps most of my friends won't love but yeah. will like. And I have this twinge of maybe I should say something. Maybe I should say something. But then I say, no, because I'm not making recommendations.
That's funny. When I write, I think I see my role dually in that I am trying to, and the primary role is to help people to think about how to see a film. In other words, if you were going to go see this film, this is maybe what you might want to look for. This is maybe how you might want to think about this film. These are things that you wouldn't, maybe as just a typical moviegoer, think about, but this might deepen your appreciation of this film. And I think that's the primary role of film criticism. But I do feel that, particularly with smaller movies, I want to try to give people a sense of, if you like this kind of film, then this might be for you. Whereas if you don't, then maybe not. Just to use my mom as an example, you know, when I first started seeing movies, a lot of movies, you know, 12 years ago, she didn't see any movies. She didn't like movies. It wasn't her thing at all. Or at least she didn't think it was her thing. But over the years, I've gotten a pretty good sense of my mom's taste. And now she sees a lot of movies because I can say, Mom, you'll kind of like this one. Mm-hmm. Now, I know what you're saying is that when you're writing to a mass audience. And so you can't have that kind of direct, you know, here's what you should see. But still, I think that what I can try to do at least a little bit is to give people a sense of, you know, yeah, if you like quiet character dramas, then I think you'll like The Visitor. And even if you're not into movies that are too rigorous, this is a very, you know, pleasant, agreeable film. And I mean that in good ways, not in pejorative ways.
Well, and quite honestly, I think that this slight, subtle, distinct difference between the way we view criticism has led to interesting discussions. Mm-hmm. For example, people can look on a previous podcast, we talked about a documentary called My Kid Could Paint That.
Right.
Now, I think you and I have actually very similar views of that movie.
Right.
And yet we disagreed in the podcast because I wanted it to speak to me in a slightly different way. Mm-hmm. You felt that the way it was speaking to people in general was a good thing. And so anyway, we don't need to talk about that movie again, but I feel like it was an interesting clash.
Yeah, that is. That's a nice point, Rob. I like that. If we agreed all the time, that'd be boring.
So I'm here at Sundance with filmmaker Tom McCarthy, who's here with his film, The Visitor. Hello, Tom.
Hello.
So tell me a little bit about where you got the idea for this film.
Usually something like this springs from a number of, I usually don't have one eureka moment. It's a collection of ideas over maybe a year, year and a half that I, you know, slowly string the story out of. I think in this case, I had spent some time in Beirut, a couple of visits there, spending time with some filmmakers and some artists and some musicians. And I think out of those visits, the character of Tariq was born, this Syrian musician who comes to New York to sort of take a shot at, you know, plying his trade and starts a little jazz trio and, you know, does what a lot of people do, want to play music. And then I sort of, you know, had this other character that Richard Jenkins ends up playing, the character of Walter Vail, this sort of aging economics professor who's sent down there for a conference. And I think I started with those two characters and thought, how do I bring these guys into the same world and what would that story entail? And from that, the script was born.
You seem to have a real affection for your characters, both in this movie and your previous movie, The Station Agent.
Yeah. Yeah, I do. You know, I spend a lot of time with them and developing them. And you know, I think that is increased more when you start working with the actors, and especially if you write for specific actors, like I did with Richard's part and with Hiyam Abbas for her role. So it's almost like you're creating it for them, and I think that calls for extra attention to detail and that type of thing. And then Haz and Danai play the young couple, Tariq being Syrian and Danai being Senegalese. I had to audition for that. I didn't have anyone in mind for that, so I went and found them the old-fashioned way.
What was it about Richard Jenkins that made you want to write a screenplay based around him?
he's just, you know, I really felt for this story. First of all, I wanted someone in the lead role that wasn't identifiable as like a huge movie star. You know, I wanted someone who could really blend. And Richard is such, I mean, even now you hear Richard's name and you're like, who is that? And then you see him and you're like, oh my God, that guy.
Yeah, yeah.
You've seen him in so many movies and TV shows and he's just so good. And it's just exciting for me to give a guy an opportunity like that, that I know was very ready for it to sort of take the movie from beginning to end. And that he could really blend and really sort of be this sort of American everyman that I was looking for in this position, in this situation, rather.
Now, you yourself are an actor, and a lot of people know you from The Wire,
yeah.
Which everyone, all my friends keep telling me to watch. I've not yet seen it.
Ah, it's a great show. Great show.
Does your experience as an actor, or how does your experience as an actor affect how you write and direct a film of your own?
I think, again, it's just attention, you know, trying to avoid some of the, you know, as an actor, you read a lot of scripts, right? And you spend a lot of time working on material, and you know when things are maybe overwritten or underdeveloped or, you know, so you just pay attention to that. And, you know, I think I always make mental notes of what would I do in this situation. And I think, you know, even on some unconscious, subconscious level, I start to apply those in my own work.
Who is the visitor?
We're getting that question a lot here at Sundance. People want answers at Sundance. I would never answer that question.
Good.
I would never answer it. I think, you know, there. In fact, you know, there's one moment where Walter goes to detention facilities, and my production designer had made these badges that say visitor on them because they actually have them at the facilities. He's like, you want to use these? And some have them and some don't in reality. And I said, you know, I don't, because I don't want to label this guy right now. I want people to take away and talk about that and decide on their own.
Yeah, it really changes from scene to scene, too. Isn't
yeah.
It?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, from the first, you know, there's the first visitor in the movie, and she certainly doesn't, I wouldn't consider her the visitor. I'm talking about the piano teacher there. And
right.
So it's like from that moment on, it keeps shifting, which I think that's why I sort of love the title.
Yeah, I do too. Do you know the Dardennes?
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, L'Enfant is sort of the same way. Who is the child?
Exactly.
It changes from scene to scene.
Exactly. Yeah, I love their movies. I have a lot of respect for those guys.
Are there other filmmakers or films that you're inspired by?
Yeah, a lot. I mean, you know, I just actually worked with a guy who I've admired for a long time. I'm going to work with him again shortly, Lucas Moodysson, in his new film, Mammoth, which we shot the first part in Bangkok, and I'm going to shoot in Sweden with him. And here's a guy, I think he's made some amazing movies.
Yeah, like Lilia Forever.
Yeah, and Show Me Love and Together, and I mean, he's just a really, I think, it really makes the kind of movies I want to make. So to have a chance to then go work with him, it's like, yeah, that's great. You know,
you'll be working as an actor on his film.
Yeah, I'm acting in that with Gael Bernal and Michelle Williams.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
What other types of movies do you think you have in your future?
It's a great question, because, you know, I'm already thinking about the next one. I've been working on some storylines, and it's a process where I don't think I can ever project what type of movie it'll be. I just got to start to find what's compelling me now, you know, what's inspiring me now, and try to, if I don't have that, if I'm not really excited about the idea, I'll never write it, because writing's a miserable pastime. But if I'm really compelled by it and excited about the research, and as you said, I fall in love with the characters, then it becomes a really enjoyable process for me.
Yeah. The Visitor isn't really, well, what do you think? Is The Visitor a political film, do you think?
I think there's political elements to it, much like we live our lives, and are we just political people? No, but I think there's political elements to our lives, you know, and I think, you know, certainly it does, you know, dealing with something now, especially, that's really on a lot of people's tongues, which is the immigration situation, but this deals with it in a different way. It really deals with the detention facilities and how we're dealing with that kind of thing. So I think there's elements, but no, first and foremost, this is about four people. It's about friendship. It's about really connecting and learning how to reconnect to people and to life. And ultimately, on some level, there's a love story there, which I think operates really well. And that's a credit to Richard and Hiam Abbas.
Yeah, and it doesn't necessarily proceed the way we expect it to, or have the finality that we might think in a typical Hollywood film.
Every Q&A, people are like, why? And this, and, you know, I think it's a realistic movie in that way. I think there's a lot of joy and hopefulness in this movie, and some very funny moments, obviously. But at the end of the day, it's realistic to the state of the world right now. And you know, not everything works out like we might hope it would, you know, especially with what's going on today.
Yeah. Seems like it's also very much about family, families that sort of span geography.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, there's actually, you know, one line. Someone brought it up to me yesterday. It was like, oh, I didn't realize Walter had a son who lived in London. That's interesting. And I don't know why. I remember writing at the time. I was like, yeah, I'm going to put his son in another part of the world. Because I think that's actually important to the story now that I think about it. Because it's like we should treat people's children coming to this country, because everyone is the child of someone, how we would like our children treated in other countries. And I think we have to move forward with that amount of empathy and respect, you know.
Yeah. Are you a musician?
No.
Ever had any inkling?
I admire them and I secretly want to be one. But no, that was funny. I actually had took djembe lessons from a friend of mine who's an author, a very talented author and a talented musician, a guy named Muhammad Ali. He lives in Brooklyn. He's of Ghanaian descent. And I tracked him down because he wrote a great book called The Prophet of Zongo Street that I read in my research. And when I found out he was a djembe player, I was like, oh, this is too good. So his band is actually, Tarek sits in for him and his band, that you see them in the movie. Yeah. And Muhammad plays in some of the more complicated drumming tracks. Mm. But he's a great guy and was very helpful in the process.
Yeah, this is the bongo-like drum that Richard Jenkins' character likes to play.
Yeah. And it's funny because, you know, someone at one of the Q&A said, now that's an African drum. Why does this Middle Eastern man play an African drum? And I was like, oh boy. You know, there's people in China playing guitars and, you know, and it's like they're all over the place. But I thought that was interesting that this woman saw it so compartmentalized that way, you know.
Yeah. Well, your film was one of my favorites at the festival. I'm really glad that you made it.
Great, great. It's a pleasure to be here.
Thanks very much.
Nice chatting. Thanks a lot, man.
A movie that we, not to shift gears, but we, I know that we agree at least a little bit on, but it's worth, I think, speaking about is Stop Loss.
Yeah.
Movie, by a director whose name I can't remember.
Kimberly Pierce.
Thanks. She did, Boys Don't Cry.
Yeah.
Which, I think most critics liked a little more than I did. I liked Boys Don't Cry and I thought the acting was particularly great. But one of the things, Stop Loss is another Iraq movie. Ryan Philippe plays this soldier, real, you know, kind of a gung-ho Texas boy. But his, you know, he hasn't had the greatest experience in Iraq, as I expect is true for many soldiers. And so he's come home pretty much ready to be done with his tour of duty, and he's going to leave the army and pursue other things, only to find out at the beginning of the film that he's been stop-lost. And what that means is that he has to go back to Iraq. He has no choice, even though he's fulfilled his 4 years. The commander-in-chief, as Bush is often called in this movie, commander-in-chief, requires him to go back to Iraq and serve as long as the commander-in-chief would have him serve. And Ryan Philippe, instead of going along with that, as thousands and thousands of other soldiers have done, decides to go AWOL. I'd love to get your response, because you've seen a lot more Iraq movies than I have. But knowing that it was the same director as Boys Don't Cry was interesting to me, because my problem with Stop Loss is somewhat similar to the problem that I have with Boys Don't Cry, is that even though I think the Kimberly Pierce has her heart in the right place, I mean, she's obviously, this is a film where she wants to say something, and she wants to say it very clearly, and you know, something that she doesn't think the rest of America has heard yet. But it becomes a bit clumsy, and that was my problem with Boys Don't Cry. So anyway, now your turn.
Yeah, I think I want to see movies looking at the Iraq experience from lots of different angles, and this is one that we haven't seen a lot of. This is a look at the guys when they come back home, trying to reintegrate into their families and their lives. In some cases, the guy is just going to be sent right back. In other cases, they have other problems. And so my first reservation about the movie was that the problems that arise are things like alcoholism, violence, problems with their wives or girlfriends. These are things that do actually happen to veterans, and that are real problems. Yeah. In this movie, they happen in 48 hours.
Right.
And so it's just compressing it like that makes it seem kind of silly.
Yeah, cliched.
But then I feel like the bigger problem is when this guy goes AWOL. We didn't explain exactly what he's doing, but he once shook the hand of a senator who praised him for being a hero, and he thinks that if he goes to Washington, D.C., the senator is going to be able to help him. And this is just, I feel like it's beyond hokey.
Yeah.
I don't believe that this guy would feel this way. Right. Certainly he's going to be disappointed. Certainly doesn't want to do it. But I feel this guy has been a soldier, and I feel it would be a really difficult thing for him to suddenly go AWOL.
Yeah.
And to do it for such a silly reason, instead of placing a phone call that he has to go talk to the senator, who probably isn't going to give him the time of day, that he has to drive there, that a pretty girl has to drive him there, rather. I'm not exactly sure why the girl needs to be there at all. It's just like one thing after another that I think this is an important story.
Mm-hmm.
And yet, if you were just really in tune with the characters, I don't think it would play out quite like this.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. And for me, I was willing to accept the fact that he was going to go AWOL. I mean, it struck me as completely implausible, but I'm willing to accept those kind of implausibilities early on in a film. I'm willing to suspend, disbelief. In other words, like, okay, I'm willing to accept this to see where it goes.
Yeah.
But then the trip itself is filled with these sort of hokey moments that, don't make any lick of narrative sense at all. I was like, what? He's walking into the VA hospital. he's not afraid of being,
noticed.
Yeah. I mean, it's just, and all sorts of things that happen that are, just not plausible. And, and therefore, if you're trying to make some kind of political statement, which clearly Ms. Pierce is trying to do, no one's going to believe that political statement because none of the story itself doesn't add up.
Yeah.
So Boys Don't Cry, I think, was a better movie, but I had the same sense of I wasn't sure I always believed it. And it felt like the message was overwhelming that, sense of narrative balance.
Yeah. One of the very early Iraq films was a documentary called The War Tapes.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking of, too.
Yeah, which ends with some of this as well. We get to see the guys we've been following in Iraq then come home, and they have similar problems. And yet in a much more compressed space, it lets them play out in a more realistic time frame. Yeah. And also there are just some shots in that film, like one of the guys comes home to a hero's welcome, mm-hmm. and his little boy latches onto him like a vice, and it just... Oh, it rips my heart out. I mean, it's, and nothing in Stop Loss did what that one shot in what The War Tapes does.
No, it's funny that you bring up that because I kept thinking of The War Tapes as I watched Stop Loss because, like you said, The War Tapes is one of the early Iraq movies. And I keep waiting for someone to make a movie, particularly a documentary, just about what it's like for soldiers to come home, because the end of that film I thought was it's just so powerful.
Yeah.
The War Tapes for me is I also particularly like because Steve James edited it, and Steve James did Hoop Dreams, and Steve James did Stevie, and he did, and it, and particularly those scenes when the soldiers come home feel like his work. It feels like the way he puts together scenes and how he's able to capture these really basic human emotions in ways that don't feel cliched in any way.
Yeah.
And so. I sort of keep hoping that Steve James's next project is about soldiers who've come home, because I'd love to see a whole movie of him doing that.
That'd be interesting, yeah.
But that leads us then to a at least more complex Iraq movie, and that's Errol Morris's Standard Operating Procedure. Why don't you introduce this one, Rob?
Well, of course, Errol Morris is a great documentarian who has made movies. His most recent one was The Fog of War about Robert McNamara. But also movies like Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, which is on my all-time favorite list, and Gates of Heaven, and The Thin Blue Line is one of his most famous. It's a documentary that actually got a guy off of death row.
That's right.
Got him exonerated. So Errol Morris, we know, is a great filmmaker. Yep. This is his look at the Abu Ghraib situation, particularly focusing on the photographs that were taken there.
Right, which were first released in the New Yorker article by Seymour Hersh, and then became, a huge embarrassment and worse for the United States.
Yeah. There have been a couple of documentaries about this before. One is The Ghosts of Abu Ghraib, and then most recently Taxi to the Dark Side, which won an Academy Award and came just before Standard Operating Procedure. And so naturally this is compared somewhat to that. And we can talk about similarities and differences.
This one, though, whereas Taxi to the Dark Side focuses on both what happened at Bagram in Afghanistan, and also what is happening in Guantanamo, and then Abu Ghraib. Morris's focuses very specifically on Abu Ghraib, and particularly on the photographs, and particularly on the people who took the photographs.
Yeah. So people like Linda England, and people who we've seen now on the news and in these photographs, people who are actually taking the photographs and involved in what was going on, are the people he is talking to. So that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's. We should also point out, if you've seen other Errol Morris documentaries, he has, what is the technique he uses, the device?
He has this thing he calls the Interitron, right, which is just a camera with sort of a teleprompter thing on the front of it, but it allows him to look directly into the eyes of the person he's interviewing, and they look directly into his eyes, and yet there's a camera recording the interviewee.
And so the talking head interviews in an Errol Morris film have a slightly different feel than you get in most documentaries. There's more of an immediacy. It feels like the people are really talking to you. And I don't know if you feel this way, Rob, but I've always felt that there was a greater connection between... It doesn't feel like a regular talking head documentary because of this Interitron. Mm-hmm. So,
I think this movie, my sort of general impression of this movie, is that it is an interesting appendix to what we know about Abu Ghraib. It's an interesting footnote, collection of footnotes, really, to the movies that we've seen about this. Which means it does have new and interesting information and another way to look at this.
What would you say were things that you learned or things that you thought were new or at least interesting?
Well, for example, he explains how they were able to arrange the photos in chronological order. You know, they were taken from three or four different cameras of different types. They're all digital photos nowadays, of course, so these eventually become files in a computer somewhere that get copied around and they get burned onto CDs. And so there's sort of an interesting... you know, investigative problem of how do you just put these in order so that we sort of know the sequence of events. And he talks to the guy who did that, and there's sort of some clever puzzles that need to be solved to get these things to line up. And he sort of visually lays them out and explains how that was done.
Yeah.
I thought that was neat. It doesn't necessarily change my view of what happened, but that's the sort of thing that is in this movie, along with an interview with Linda England and some people who I haven't seen interviewed at length before.
Yep.
So that was new. The most troubling thing about it is that Errol Morris did some reenactments, which has become a staple of his movies, because they worked very well in a movie like Thin Blue Line,
yes, they do.
Where they really helped clarify things. People are giving us their recollection of what happened, and we see it play out. But we see it play out in different ways because their recollections are different, and it helps situate objects and people in this timeline. Here, the purpose of the reenactments is very hazy. But not only that, it's been very aestheticized. Yeah. The images are, I hate to say it, but they're beautiful. Yeah. I mean, what I mean by this, they're immaculately lit. Yeah. There's blood splattered like in a horror film. Mm-hmm. There are dogs barking in slow motion at the camera in this sort of terror-inducing way with these creepy sound effects. And I begin to think, what are we watching and why?
Yeah, and the lighting is beautiful. In the reenactments, you know, it's not just that, you know, the blood feels like a horror film. It's the shadows feel like, you know, a horror film or some film noir. And, you know, the way the light cuts diagonally across the rooms is very evocative of, you know, sort of almost classic Hollywood filmmaking.
But no photo I've seen of this prison and no recollection that I've heard or read looks like Errol Morris' soundstage does.
Yeah.
I mean, this is an expensive looking.
Yeah. It is. Yeah. And I have the same reservation, and actually more than a reservation. I find it really troubling because Errol Morris is a really smart man. I mean, you can tell that just from his movies, and he's a guy who's really thought through what he wants to do. But for me, it feels like the heavy stylization of these reenactments feels perverse. It feels to me like it's trying to do something that I'm not sure what it's trying to do, but whatever it's trying to do, it either doesn't succeed or I'm really offended by it because it's designed almost to make it look sexier or to make it more, I don't know, appealing or not appealing, but more intense maybe.
Yeah.
As if Morris didn't think the photos can stand on their own and he needed to trick him up a bit. Errol Morris took a lot of flack when he did Thin Blue Line 10, 12, 15 years ago. I forget when that film was made. But for the reenactments, you know, that was a very controversial move in a documentary to recreate events. I have no problem with those reenactments. I know when I interviewed Errol Morris for The Fog of War several years ago, he was still sort of answering this question about reenactments as, you know, trying to justify that. And I have no problem with it in Thin Blue Line. But here it feels of a different order. It feels like it's merely style and not substance, and I find that troubling, particularly in this kind of film.
Yeah. I have another problem with the movie, and I'm curious to get your take on this. We see interviews with all of the low-level people who are involved in this, or at least most of them. We do see an interview with the Brigadier General, who was the highest-ranking person to take a fall for this, who may have been a scapegoat, in fact, and that's her, that's of course her claim.
And it stridently claims.
Yes, not only in this movie, but also in other movies that have been made about this. She's very vocal about that. But most of the people we see, other than her, are the very low-level people who are directly involved. Now, on the one hand, you could say they got a chance to make their case. But let's rewind a little bit to talk about Errol Morris's previous two movies. The previous one was The Fog of War, about Robert McNamara. I like that movie a lot. And I felt that a part of Errol Morris's strategy in that movie was to give McNamara enough rope to hang himself.
Absolutely.
Perhaps not hang himself, but get himself tied up in the knots, right?
Yeah. No, that's right.
Maybe he reveals things he doesn't realize he's revealing. He tells Errol Morris to edit something out, and Errol Morris includes it in the movie to you know, show who's in charge.
No, that's right.
And to show that McNamara's a control freak, et cetera, you know, things like that.
No.
So we have to assume that that's a part of Morris's strategy with The Fog of War. I think the same was true of his previous movie, Mr. Death, which is about a guy named Fred Luker.
That's right.
This is a movie who, among other, about a guy who, among other things, is a Holocaust denier. But he sort of bumbles into being a Holocaust denier because of his ego. This sounds strange, but if you watch the movie, that's sort of how it's presented.
Right.
Now, Morris doesn't say very much directly about this guy or about Robert McNamara, for that matter. He only lets them talk. But he edits it, and he's in control of the editing. And so we can assume that, and we can clearly see the same sorts of things are happening. The guy says things that are ridiculous. Every once in a while, he will clearly contradict what the guy is saying with another shot, but usually he just lets him talk and we just know it's ridiculous. Well, some people thought that that was going too easy on a guy who denies the Holocaust. I disagree because it's so clear that I don't need movies to tell me everything, and I certainly know that Errol Morris doesn't believe this guy.
Right.
Okay, so then coming now to standard operating procedure, he's talking mostly to the people who've been called a few bad apples.
I
and a lot of other people don't believe that this is a problem of a few bad apples. There's some systemic problem here, and Taxi to the Dark Side is trying to unpack that and trying to figure that out. Here, on the one hand, I think he's letting them make their case, but on the other hand, since that's those are the only people who appear before his camera, and since this is how his camera works, whether he is always conscious of it or not, he does undercut the things that they're saying. He definitely holds them accountable. And I'm not saying that they should be excused for the horrible things that they did, but when he parades one person after another before the camera and they all say, well, it was sort of set up this way when I got there and I thought it was weird, but you know, more than one person says that and you know he creates this echo on purpose to undermine what they're saying. Well, that would be okay if maybe he weren't these weren't the only people in his argument. Where are the other people who he's going to undermine with that technique?
No, it's true. I don't think I was quite as troubled as that as you are when I was first watching it. I don't think I quite realized how much he was letting these people sort of take the fall. But certainly as I've thought about it and as you and I have talked over email, I've said, yeah, that's right. Those people, you know, and again, it's not like I admire these people in any way, and you know, and the pictures they took and sort of how they approach it is you know, in many ways reprehensible. But still, you know, as Taxi to the Dark Side, I think, makes, you know, really clear, this sort of stuff was coming from the various highest reaches of the Bush administration and had been sort of put in place well before Abu Ghraib even was a prison. You know, it had started at Bagram, it had started at Guantanamo. And then it worked in those places, and so let's do the same thing in Abu Ghraib. So no, I think that's a fair critique. One thing that I found interesting about the film, to jump off that, is there are a couple people who sort of claim that they were trying to document what was going on. In other words, they were taking pictures because they wanted to cover their butt in case, you know, it came out what was going on there.
And some of them said so contemporaneously. For example, a woman was writing a letter back to family saying that this is what she was doing.
Well, my question for you is, did you believe that?
No. But partly because I think Errol Morris leads me to disbelieve that. And in one of the ways, there are several ways, but one is, you know, he shows her smiling at the camera and giving a thumbs up, and he lets her explain that she doesn't really know what to do with her hands in pictures, and all she can do is smile and give a thumbs up. Well, that's a pretty feeble explanation for the horror that's going on, right?
But yet he doesn't come out and contradict the woman. And so I'm left with this really troubling notion, is that I don't know whether I should believe her or not. Now, maybe Morris is being sophisticated and saying, yeah, what, who can you believe kind of thing. But on this note, I think we can, you know, establish certain things. You know, are there letters?
Yeah.
Is there a diary? If there is, let's see it. Because then that would sort of really validate her case that, yeah, maybe she... maybe she's not as pure as she might want to say, but you know, she was taking photos to try to you know, because she was uncomfortable with what was going
on. Yeah, or that's what she said at the time.
Right. And so is her story believable or not? And it seems to me that Morris could pretty easily document whether it's believable or not. And yet I don't know enough in this film to know.
Yeah, I agree.
And so for me, I have no problem with Errol Morris making Robert McNamara look foolish. I think that's part of what Morris does really well. But these people have already been really dumped on in the media. I mean, they've already received their punishment and more for what they did. And so the fact that Morris sort of holds them up to ridicule again, or at least in some ways ridicule, I find troubling.
Well, and not only the media, but Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld,
yeah,
people
right.
who did have power to do something about right. this, or whose lack of action right. at the very least may have been right. responsible for this, they're the ones who were using terms like a few bad apples. Mm-hmm. So I'm just looking for somebody to set the record aright, you
yeah.
know?
And I will give Morris this, and I think you and I disagree on this point, but I do think that as convoluted as certain parts of the movie are, the very fact of the title, Standard Operating Procedure, it comes from this moment near the end of the movie where this lawyer, he's looking at the pictures and he's describing each picture, each act in the picture of whether that is illegal and therefore can be tried in court, or whether it's quote unquote standard operating procedure according to Army rule. And most of them are standard operating procedure. You know, a few are he determines are illegal, but most of them are standard operating procedure. And so, and knowing Morris's politics, which are at least progressive, I'm sure that he doesn't see them as a few bad apples. He sees this as systemic. He sees this as a fundamental problem with the Army,
mm-hmm.
and with the Bush administration. And yet again, it's not as clear as I think it should be. You know, again, this is not a point for ambiguity, I don't think.
Yeah.
I don't know how you felt about that.
Yeah, I agree. It's not that he doesn't indict anyone else. You know, there are definitely nods to lots of people who are outside of this movie, and yet the most powerful thing that he does in this movie and other movies is the on-screen interview that's edited accordingly.
Right.
And so that's why I focused on that. Mm-hmm. I will say one thing. A lot of people have immediately come out of the gate and compared this movie to Taxi to the Dark Side mm-hmm. and found this lacking.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that we need to have definitive movies about Iraq or even
right.
about a slice of Iraq. I don't think that that's necessary or even productive. I think that it's very important for us to look at many aspects of this, and that's going to take more than one movie.
Yeah.
And so I certainly think, and I think Errol Morris proves, that there are things that we can still know
sure.
about Abu Ghraib that weren't covered mm-hmm. in Taxi to the Dark Side, which was making a very clear
mm-hmm.
argument for one particular thing. And so I think the standard operating procedure actually has value. I think
yep.
there's a lot of good stuff in it. I think it's also weirdly organized and has a lot of such troubling things that I can't,
mm-hmm.
that I'm having trouble even...
Well, I agree. I mean, I don't want to sound like I hate this movie, because I don't. I think there's interesting things. I think the interviews with the people are interesting. I appreciate Morris trying to understand sort of a timeline of what happened at Abu Ghraib. But I guess I expect more of him.
Yeah.
You know, because I do think he's a brilliant filmmaker. I think Fog of War is one of the really great documentaries of the last 10 years. And his other films, I think, are all, almost without exception, strong, strong works. And so I was looking for, maybe it was my expectations, but I was looking for him to sort of bring a real strong personal sense of this horrible situation and how it fits in with American policy. And yet it feels very muddled to me, and particularly on the issue just of images themselves. I mean, if you're going to make a movie about photographs, then you want to think real long and hard about the look of your own movie. And so if yet you contrast these sort of grainy, ugly digital photographs with Robert Richardson's, you know, gorgeous cinematography of these reenactments. Well, I'm not sure that's a wise choice, and I'll be curious to hear what Morris has to say about that.
Yeah, you refer to it as a muddle. It is. I feel confused afterward about what he about Abu Ghraib itself. Like it's a big old ball of confusion. Right. You could say, well, yes, the situation is a ball of confusion. That's why the movie that reflects it is a ball of confusion. But what we want from filmmakers, and especially Errol Morris, is clarity.
Yeah.
Help us piece this confusion together. Help us figure this out. We all know it's confusing.
Well, and for me, there are certain situations in which I'm willing to embrace ambiguity, where, in other words, the modern media tries to say everything is clear. Well, good, let's come along and remind us that things aren't always crystal clear. On Abu Ghraib, I think the stakes are too high for that. You know, for me, I need someone to come along and say, this is just horrifying. And the fact that it was done in my name is triply horrifying. And let's assign blame. I mean, 'cause it's not like there's no one to blame here.
Or at least let's figure it out.
Yeah.
Let's understand.
But sometimes there are things that are clear. And for me, Abu Ghraib is one of those sort of clear moments of what has gone wrong with this administration. And I expected Errol Morris to be able to say the same. And I don't think this movie does.
Well, that's going to wrap up this edition of the Errata Movie Podcast, but it won't wrap up our discussion of this movie. In fact, hold on. Wait a minute. All right. This has happened several times on this podcast. You know, we see a complicated movie, we talk about it, and it feels like things are not really resolved. And so here's what happened. Errol Morris went to Chicago to talk about standard operating procedure and sat down with J. Robert Parks, who asked him some questions. Then he came to San Francisco, showed his film again, and answered questions from an audience, and talked about the movie. So from all of these experiences, seeing the movie again, listening to Errol Morris talk about the movie, did they change our opinion? Did they clarify anything? Maybe. We'll talk about that next time. For more information about this podcast and to listen to other episodes in this series, you can go to erratamag.com/podcast. That's erratamag.com. There you can send us email, leave us a comment, or if you prefer to give us an audio comment, call 415-287-4020. Nobody's going to answer. You don't have to talk to anybody, but you can record your voice and we'll hear it. We'll be back next time to talk more about standard operating procedure. Oh, but first, we need to give the answers to the photo caption contest. We have two winners. We had two photos, and we have a winner for each photo. I didn't think this would work. We of course all know that colors in a photograph reflect light differently. I just didn't realize they reflect sound differently. But someone said, you know, hold it up to a microphone. And it's, you know, I didn't think it would work, but we got two really good captions. And so here's the first. Before we hear the captions, let me show the photos again. Here's the first one. Okay. The winning caption is, "The Commander-in-Chief gives away the bride." Pretty good, huh? I mean, I was trying to think of, something about a cake or jumping out of a cake, and I couldn't think of anything funny. But that was a good one. Okay, now let me show the second photo. Okay, and the winning caption is, "Only the gods see everything." Yeah, it's very clever. Of course, that's a line in the new Indiana Jones movie. But we have a runner-up caption, actually. The runner-up was, "The man with the X-ray ears." Anyway, those are two very clever ones. We went with the... Only the gods see everything because it fits the photo a little better, of course. But those are both good, and we thank you for sending them, whoever you are. Next time, we're going to ask you to include your name and an email address so that we can give you some sort of a prize, or at least, you know, announce who the winners are. But take pride if you wrote those in knowing that they were the best that we received. We'll be back next week to talk about Standard Operating Procedure in depth. Bye.